Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. Our special guest today is Sean O'Toole. Sean O'Toole is the founder of PropertyRadar.com. He began his very successful career as Silicon Valley entrepreneur, working with people and starting up companies. He's a personal friend, and we have gone on trips together down to Washington, D.C. to do some research. And PropertyRadar.com is a big advantage to any investor or realtor has access to it. It helps them navigate the real estate market and find things much easier than you would have any other way. Sean, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
One of the things that is a little disappointing this year are sales. So Carr projected, they usually take a look at projections, and I would have agreed with their projections. I figured we would be at the mid-450s, maybe even higher as far as 450,000 sales in California. And for much of the first 3 or 4 months, I think we bounced around 360, and we've had maybe 1 month where it would have panned out at about 390. But pretty disappointing retail sales. What do you think is going on there?
Well, to me, I think the basic problem is that your prediction last year was right in terms of price growth, and that I was wrong. So, and I think that set us up for bad sales. You know, look, we had this big jump in prices last year, and you know, we had a change in interest rates, which also impacts affordability, right? So as rates go up, a person with a given income can afford less. And, you know, and that further took a bite out of affordability. And I think those two things combined, we started seeing a real decline in sales, more than just the seasonal decline at the end of last year. And it's continued to this year. And I think it will continue basically because we're back at a point where prices exceed what people can afford.
Okay, we're gonna park here for a while because, to be honest with you, this one drives me nuts a little bit, because historically, when affordability goes down, volume goes up. I mean, that's consistent in the 80s and 90s, 2000 to 2005. So even though mathematically what you're saying absolutely feels like it has to be true, the less people can afford, the less participation they will have, it's never been that way. And so this time it's true that we have less volume of sales, but I don't know how to peg it to affordability because it's never been that way. So when prices...
Actually, I think it has been. And I think the problem is how others measure affordability, right? So if you look at CARs or NARs calculation for affordability, it's pretty static. It only takes into account interest rate. I think credit terms, debt to income ratios, and the rest are a lot more important for pay option arms with teaser rates. And so where we had low affordability in the past from a CAR metric standpoint, we actually had very high affordability from the standpoint of a pay option teaser arm. So you have to use that different pay option teaser arm as your affordability metric, not CAR's 30-year 20% down payment calculation. And that's what's fundamentally different this time, because this time credit terms aren't loosening.
And I think that's really where I wanted to land, is that, you know, it's just too simplistic to say that because people can afford less, naturally volume went down, when that isn't what happened. But what you've described is the reason, is that people that used to get a yes answer are getting no answers.
And I still fundamentally call that affordability, just not affordability that can be tracked on an affordability index that's based on 30-year financing, 20% down.
Right.
And doesn't take into account these other factors that I think are really what drive the market.
Well, the challenge of that is, you know, and I really have thought about this and considering all those metrics and going back to see the implementation of all those other programs that made it more and more and more affordable as prices went up because it required less and less of the borrower as far as in qualification. I guess what I'm thinking is that maybe there, I have to recalculate where a likely stopping point of affordability is this time. Because normally I look at 17% and I see that being pretty consistent. And now if the rules of financing have changed and it's permanent, then there's no way it's going to get there. I haven't really bought into that yet, to be honest with you, because I see areas like a San Jose, like a San Francisco, having flown by their former price point. I haven't looked at their affordability, but I know the human being is still the same.
I think San Jose is a really good example, right? Because so if you take a look at San Jose, San Francisco, the whole Silicon Valley, if you look at affordability versus, you know, the way they usually do it is, you know, the census income data for the median household income for that area.
Right.
And from that standpoint, right, we're blowing out affordability there. But how we're blowing out affordability is by displacing those median income families for new families that are coming in for high opportunities that pay significantly more than the median income has traditionally been. So, you know, what you have there is a gentrification issue blowing through affordability rather than credit terms.
I think that's what's fun about this subject is that you're never done looking at looking at the new twist that you didn't know you'd ever have to study. I never think I'm done, but, you know, this time it's different in even in the participants. So we have a huge group of a lot of buying going on with hedge funds because real estate became the asset of choice for a short period of time in California. And then when prices accelerated, I'm not sure, but haven't they gone to other states and went to Nevada certainly and went to Phoenix area? Are they still finding areas that they're very active in, or are they kind of sitting?
They're kind of in Phoenix, maybe even before California, or at least in parallel. I think that that market's kind of over on that front as well as I think this market is. You know, the LLC, LP purchases have really declined here, and I think what's left is primarily not these institutions. There's a little bit of it still going on, but I don't think it's the institutional buy and hold guys really doing much in California at this point.
One of the things that they now have brought billions of dollars to is financing for investors.
Yeah, you know, well, I think as they learned about this whole market and the rest, they saw that there was, I won't say an unserved market, because obviously the Norris Group and a handful of others serve it really well, at least in your case. But they saw an opportunity to, you know, still make really good returns while offering, you know, whatever. So, you know, I think they learned a lot about these markets and saw some new opportunities that they didn't know about previously.
What I think is interesting about that, when we were invited back to Washington, D.C., and there was a room full of those guys, okay, and I was on a panel. And the first thing I said, remember you and I went back to Washington and we spoke in front of Fannie and Freddie and we talked about, or Fannie and FHA, talking about financing for investors. And
yeah.
What year was that? 2010?
2010, I think, yeah.
Yeah. So that was my first comment. I said, I really appreciate being invited here. I just wondered why you didn't show up in 2010. Because that was really the place that, first of all, the lowest risk existed. And you know, they're 4 years late, and I think it's going to run its course almost like the buying of properties. I think they're going to find the niche of, okay, you own 40 properties, let me help you refi it. But are they going to really get down to the level of, you know, and find enough volume to place their billions of dollars? And the reason why I think that answer is important, and I'm not sure exactly what it is, but I think the answer will be they're not going to find enough business there, and that big pile of money will land in the occupant borrower's lap with creative programs eventually. That would be my guess.
That would be interesting. You know, I think even though it's a big pile of money, it would be a pin drop in the owner-occupant market.
And that's my point right now, and that's what I mentioned to the audience. I said, I think you've shown up 4 years late, and I think that you're going to go through your $3 billion, and you're going to be primarily done. Where if you really went after the owner-occupant with a low down payment or stated income in a market that's not priced out yet, I think that would be a very safe loan. And so there would be tens of billions, if not $100 billion, that they could put in bonds and probably have a successful outcome.
So the problem there is, I mean, you and I are in violent agreement on that. The problem there is that the regulatory pendulum has swung so far against owner-occupant loans that it's really hard for me to see smart money wanting to take that bet.
I guess, you know, I can see that I'm already seeing, I just got sent one yesterday by Greg, where there's programs out there for lower and lower FICO scores and stated income. I don't know the down payment requirements and all that. But somebody is going to go after and capture a big chunk of business, and then their competitors are going to look at that and say, oh, man, you know. And they're actually getting paid by, you know, 99.9% of their borrowers. So that niche, you know, we want to participate in. But it hasn't happened in any quantity yet. So I guess that's what's next. And, you know, if that doesn't happen, it'll be real interesting to see what volume continues to be possible in California, because I don't think everybody is going to be too excited about California at 380,000 sales in 2014 and 2015.
No, and I really think that, you know, there's kind of two things that solve that, or there's three possible ways to solve that. One is looser credit, which is the point you're making, right?
Right.
Two is some sort of major economic growth that leads to higher wages, which we're seeing in Silicon Valley and San Francisco, but not much, you know, throughout the rest of the state. And long-term incomes have been declining since the 70s or something, right?
Right.
And then, you know, at least on an inflation-adjusted basis. And then three, you know, is just general, or three is a price decline. So if we see prices come back down and affordability improve, then, you know, I think that happens as well. What I don't see right now is, it's not clear to me that any three of those things happen. I think sellers don't, you know, fought back to get to where they are right now and are not anxious to start dropping prices. I don't see incomes rising substantially. And I don't see credit loosening up when we're still talking about how to shut down Fannie and Freddie. And, you know, there's still so much fear over loss that, you know, and the belief that regulatory rules are how you contain loss. You know,
yeah.
I think we're stuck with slower sales for a while, honestly.
Okay. Well, and that, unfortunately, that exacerbates the employment issue, because if you're a builder, you're not going to start developing houses with, and land's pretty expensive now. So you almost have to say, okay, well, by the time we get done with these lots, prices are going to substantiate all this work we just did. So there's enough uncertainty where you probably have, and you still have lot construction in Riverside County, which is really where a lot of construction is usually done, at about 85% down from a normal number. So developers are not just going crazy creating lots. They're definitely not. And so if you only have 380,000 sales in 2014, I can't imagine the builder being a bigger and bigger percentage with, you know, unless they just throw caution to the wind. But, and if they don't do that, then employment is really going to still have a problem.
I think the key for builders and how we could get builder volume up is, I'm fairly convinced that we have an issue of having some of the wrong inventory in California. Especially in the boom, we built too many McMansions in the distant suburbs, especially in areas where it's 100 degrees and it costs you $600 a month to air condition the 4,000 square foot house.
Right.
So I think there's opportunities for builders to build, kind of the right products in the right areas. We've seen things, even in Las Vegas, which was super hard hit, one of the best performing subdivisions in the nation, according to John Burns, is in Vegas. They really built the right product in the right area at the right time. And it was built before the crash and didn't suffer like all the areas around it to nearly the same degree and came back quickly. It's one of the hottest markets in Las Vegas today. And I think that there's lots of opportunities for smart builders to build, you know, the right product in the right place. And I think they have to stop looking at these big macro. There's only 380,000 units being sold and say, well, why is that? Is that because there's a bunch of units that are the wrong units at the wrong price in the wrong place?
Okay. What do you feel is the impact of the foreign investor in California? I know their volume has been growing. Do they pick and choose very specific areas and they mostly affect that specific area?
Yeah, I think that's somewhat true. It's usually someplace where they're going to have family or somebody to help keep an eye on the property. I run into a lot of folks at the real estate investment clubs that are buying up real estate, and it's clear that they're part of a larger family and they're the ones that moved out to America to put some of that money to work. We've seen that even in the foreclosure investing family funds of even funds of folks here that are live in and are based in the U.S. and, have some family wealth for whatever reason and are looking to put that someplace that's a good inflation hedge.
Mm-hmm.
And real estate's a great inflation hedge. And if you're, in China and you're worried about a bubble there and you want something that's more likely to perform well over the long term, I think real estate here looks pretty good. Think about Japan, where you the so-called lost decade that's now extended well beyond that, where 2% returns on money is still pretty good. To come here and get 5-7% return on money is double, triple what you're doing at home. So, I think there's really compelling reasons for it. I don't think we have very good data on it, and I think like many things, like investor purchases, every house is going to an investor. Well, at the peak, it was 6.5%, right, of sales were going to investors. So, and I think this story is similar, right? It's certainly happening. It's certainly a portion of the market, but it's not as big a deal as everybody makes it out to be.
When I speak, I always get the question, what's going to be the effect of the hedge funds selling all their properties at the same time? What's your take on that?
So the example I like to give, and this may not be an obvious enough example, right? So China owns trillions of dollars of U.S. Treasuries, or $1 trillion, or $800 billion, something like that, right?
Right.
And they probably love to dump some of that, just to mess with us. But if they do, the value of the rest of that money will suddenly go down. So if they were to dump $100 billion worth of treasuries, their other $700 billion, I don't know what the current numbers are, would, probably drop dramatically. So they're kind of cutting their own throat.
Right.
And my big picture thing is, unless there's some sort of major market panic, the chances that the hedge funds will cut their own throats is zero. And, they're like the banks. They're smart enough to know that, okay, I've got all these assets. If I want to unload them, I can't just go put them all on the market in one day because I'm going to have a real problem on my hands. Back in 2004, there was a gentleman in Sacramento that in the 90s bought up 300 rentals. And he decided he was ready to sell all of his rentals. We're talking 300 properties here, right?
In right.
A state of 12 million properties. And he sent eviction notices to all 300 properties, and the governor intervened, right, over 300 properties.
Okay.
So, it's just not going to happen.
Well, a lot of the business models are different, too. So the hedge funds, not all of them have the intention of selling the inventory. Some of them formed REITs, and those are like scattered apartments that they're going to hold, is my understanding.
Absolutely, yes.
So not
and the hedge funds, had their exit, right? They took their initial investment dollars, and now they've put into a REIT, which means they've been paid.
That's right. They're done.
They're done. And so you've got some managers in place now, but if the managers sell off that property, they're putting themselves out of work. What's their incentive? It's not going to happen.
Yeah, I agree with that. Anything overall, and now we're maybe talking economically, whatever's going on, anything concern you in the immediate horizon that might affect value of real estate?
You know, personally, in my mind, there's no question to me that the stock market's in an unhealthy place. And we have a fundamental issue, you know, and I don't know that that's going to correct anytime soon because the Fed is propping this up and continues despite their announcement that they're going to, you know, finish tapering asset purchases and the rest. In 2008, things fundamentally changed. If you look at the long-term kind of GDP growth and you draw a line through that, we have a bunch of new debt and we have a fundamental output gap. I mean, we're growing again, so we're not technically in recession, but if you look at that long-term line, it zigs and it doesn't recover.
Right.
Even from the Great Depression, that line recovered back to trend.
Right.
It's not recovering this time at all. This is fundamentally different. And I don't think the markets, the Fed, interest rates, lots of things are in. We still have a lot of artificial stimulation going on in this market. And I think at some point, I don't know whether that point is 6 months from now or 20 years from now. I think that fundamentally concerns me. I just have zero visibility on how that unfolds and when it unfolds.
What are the ramifications of being below trend? That's GDP growth being under what it should be and not even playing catch up to where, especially when the demographics shift. So now you have more and more people wanting to collect Social Security and be on Medicare. That's a big bill that's going to have a hard time being paid for.
As well as interest payments on debt that we continue to accumulate.
Yeah, and of course, at interest rates as they are, that's not a big deal.
Assuming they can control and manage those interest rates. But we put ourselves in this trap where we have to have low interest rates. So, you know, we've created a world where we're stealing from savers to make profits for banks and, you know, prop up, you know, welfare and social programs. But, you know, all that's coming on the back of savers. And I think that's, and in investors, you know, small business people and the rest. And I just think that puts us economically at a pretty long-term, you know, lost decades kind of disadvantage that's not healthy.
Well, and I was just writing as you were talking that, you know, Japan has that debt situation and the interest situation to where if they had a fluctuation of an interest rate, even 0.5%, that could be a very big problem for the debt level that they have. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. When you say that, and we only have 30 seconds, you feel that real estate is a good hedge against inflation?
Yeah, I mean, regardless of how this other stuff, you know, works out, I mean, if it ends up completely blowing up, at the end of the day, you know, so long as you haven't picked some real estate that's uninhabitable and undesirable, people still need a place to live. And if they've got to pay you in chickens, at least you're getting paid.
That's true. I haven't thought about collecting rent in such a fashion, though. Sean, we've run out of time. Go to propertyradar.com and become a customer. It's the best thing you can do in our industry. Sean, thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.